This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Actor Gary Cole says sometimes theater becomes more than theater, as when the ISU alum took a play about the Vietnam War out to a veterans facility.
And it became a tradition at the theater that still holds today is that the first audience, before the previews begin, it's called the final dress rehearsal, is a theater filled with American veterans. And now we have more wars to head on.
Hear Colleen Reynolds' interview with Cole. Plus, Mother's Day approaches. We consider the complicated position of moms and children's literature. And a Nashville country rockers in Twin Cities. We'll talk. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Four community organizations in Bloomington Normal have now written a set of principles for a proposed police citizen review board in Bloomington and detailed how they think it should work. GLT's Judy Valente has more with Jennifer Carrillo of the YWCA about what the groups are asking.
Some of those principles include creating more avenues for submission of civilian complaints, understanding that for many folks it can be very intimidating to have to file the complaint at the police department, which is the only current option. So we'd like to see those options expanded. In Urbana, the city human resources department can take a complaint. And then we'd also like to propose that if we establish a civilian review board, that entity would also be capable of taking complaints. We'd also like independent review of civilian complaints. So while BPD would still be in charge of conducting the main investigation, we'd like for there to be an opportunity that if someone receives the conclusion of the complaint and is not satisfied, that they can then appeal to a second set of eyes that is made up of peers and civilians who would be able to go through and look at what BPD looked at and determine whether they are on the same page or whether they have recommendations for the department. So once that second set of eyes has looked at the investigation, it includes the ability for the CRB to issue recommendations to the chief of police or the city manager or whomever the appropriate party would be, who would then retain final consideration and execution about what the appropriate action step is within the department. Finally, and I think very importantly, we would like the CRB to have the opportunity to make recommendations on departmental policies and practices so that we don't have to start the conversation over again every time that something happens or a change needs to be made. So we'd like this review board to also serve as an advisory to the police to help them build more trust within the community.
Why is this something that YWCA would be backing?
One of our policy priorities is to end racial profiling and the criminalization of people of color. So this falls very much in line with what we're trying to do. It is hard to make recommendations for how to improve the police department, how to help them do their jobs better, how to have a collaborative relationship with them when we don't have the data. And unfortunately, there's a huge disconnect in the community where we hear lots of folks saying that they're not satisfied with the current process, but who aren't coming forward and filing formal complaints. So, you know, I think one first step to figuring out how we can make our community safer for everybody and how community can work best with police is to start to remove some of those barriers that keep people from speaking up when something has happened to them that they don't believe to be fair.
Do you have any sense of movement on the part of the police department?
I think Chief Hefner wants what's best for the community, and I think hearing from various stakeholders about the positives that this would bring might help give him a sense of assurance that the purpose of the CRB isn't to say, well, the police are bad and look at all the bad things they're doing, but rather an effort from folks in the community to say, hey, we want to help you make the best out of this department, and we want to play a role in that, and we understand that you all are the experts on the one side of the equation, but we are the folks who are kind of interacting with police officers day in and day out. So here are some things that we think would be helpful to incorporate into your model of community policing. So if this is perceived to be an attack, then of course there would be some resistance. But I think once he hears from folks who genuinely have no other agenda than to make the community a safer, better place and a just place for everybody, I hope that he is able to hear that.
Jennifer Carrillo of the YWCA spoke with GLT's Judy Valente.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Mom's Day is coming up. A look at moms in literature. Illinois State University alum actor Gary Cole has an IMDb profile that's longer than a gang member's rap sheet, so you might be surprised he's often asked by random people if he's famous, as in they recognize him from somewhere. Cole is among the busiest actors in the business. He's currently on 6 TV shows and has 2 movies coming out this year. The star of such movies as Office Space, One Hour Photo, and Talladega Nights, and TV shows such as The West Wing, The Good Wife, and Veep was inducted yesterday into the Illinois State University Fine Arts Hall of Fame. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds sat in during a Q&A with theater students following the ceremony and talked with the actor.
Actor Gary Cole back at Illinois State University to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, and you've got commencement where you're also going to give a speech as well. How does it feel to be back on this campus?
Well, it's extraordinary. I was actually back here in 2003, so I've visited since I've been here, but it's certainly been a while. And it certainly brings a lot of memories to the surface, all of them good, as far as I can tell. But it's great to be back and to see all the... The town is hard to recognize now. It wasn't quite the metropolis that it was in 1977 when I left. So, yeah, it's a lot of big improvements.
What's a favorite memory you have from an experience here?
To me, it's the whole thing. I don't have individual experiences necessarily that I recall other than a lot of critical training that I received that served me well afterwards. A lot of faculty members that I remember just moments of... sometimes confusing, but coming from high school to here and still being a performer is a big transition. And I just remember kind of really getting the bug and falling in love with performing. And that happened here. I mean, it happened early for me right away, but here was a place that really, that was solidified. I was either cursed or blessed to say, I'm going to be an actor. So,
were you one of the favored actors while you were here?
Well, favored, I don't know. I worked. I can't recall the amount of productions, but I was able to get a lot of experience, you know, so I did my fair share of productions. And all of them, and they were very varied. You know, there were all different kinds of, I remember I did Restoration comedy and I did Shakespeare. I did plays that were written by students here at the university that were in competition for regional festivals. I did all kinds of things. Did a few musicals here and there, or plays with music. And that was a great training ground, to be able to do and execute a lot of things. It helped me later, because having some diversity can prolong your existence, your shelf life, as it were.
And you've had a really, I mean, you've got shelf life. You have endured, and you have a very busy, long, varied career. Do you have a secret to that?
I don't know. I don't think that it's something that you don't really have. That's out of your hand. All you can do is recognize what an opportunity is and then try to capitalize on the opportunity. Sometimes obtaining opportunities is out of your hand. I think it's more important that if you do get one, to make it count. Being able to do different kinds of things is certainly helpful, you know, but there's, like I said, there's no handbook in how to, you know, last.
You advise these students, and seemed like very good advice, worry about the show and hopefully the business will follow. At what point in your career were you able to say no to something?
Well, I think you can make choices and of what you want to do and will do for a number of different reasons. But
right, but you know, you're taking the commercials, you're taking what comes at you when you're early in your career. When did you start feeling like, you know, I have the luxury to say that's not great material?
I never think that I have a luxury to do anything, period. I just base it on what I want to do, what I think is possible in looking at something. But I can't target a time that I focused on that, I wouldn't say.
So there's not a role that maybe you said, no, I don't think that's for me, that you regretted saying no?
I've never turned down anything that I regretted not doing, no. If there was something I really wanted to do and somebody offered it to me, I would have done it. And the reason I would have done it is because it had something, and if it meant something after the fact and I hadn't done it, chances are I probably would have said yes to it anyway.
I'm Colleen Reynolds, and this is Sound Ideas. We're talking with actor Gary Cole, an ISU alumnus who is back on campus. He was inducted into the Fine Arts Hall of Fame. He'll also be giving a commencement address this weekend. I'll go back to my interview in a minute, but Cole also took questions from theater students for about an hour, and some of them were really great. So I'm going to play at least one of them for you. This is from theater student Abby Brenner.
Hi.
Hi.
Are there any, when you look back on your whole career, are there any landmark roles or productions or experiences, whether it be theatrical, film, television, that you carry with you now as an actor?
One that was profound to me was early on at Steppenwolf was a play called Tracers, which was created by Vietnam veterans in Los Angeles. And Gary Sinise saw the play, and at the time, I'm not sure if he was the artistic director or not, but Gary Sinise was one of the premier directors of the company through the 80s, and he saw that and was able to acquire the rights for Steppenwolf. And we had a long process of rehearsal for that. We happened to have a few veterans in the cast, just by coincidence. They were actors in Chicago. It started a tradition at the theater, which was that we visited veterans, and primarily Vietnam veterans, in psychiatric hospitals and in substance abuse hospitals, but they were exclusively for veterans. And this was Gary's idea, and he brought the play with and said, we're doing this. We want you to see this. Not the play, I mean, we want you to look at the script, and we want you to tell us. It had been created by veterans, and we had discussions about it. They were impactful, you know. And then it started a tradition of, we invited groups of these audiences of exclusively veterans to the theater to see the play and would have discussions after they saw the play. And it became a tradition at the theater that still holds today, is that the first audience preview, before the previews begin, it's called the final dress rehearsal, is a theater filled with American veterans from whatever, you know, and now we have more wars to add on to that. That is, it's kind of difficult to describe the impact of that, but you can imagine. And that's when, you know, I guess theater can really be something beyond what happens just when the lights go up and the lights go down. Because they were instrumental in what they gave to us when we would go out there after we had these encounters with them to perform this play, you know. So
you're famous. Are you the right amount of famous for you?
I'm happy with the level of famous, but famous is a strange word. But, you know, this is the question I often get asked. Are you famous? And I say, well, apparently not overly so. You know, I'm recognizable sometimes to certain people, and that's fine with me. Again, that's something that you have no control over, and you have to just roll with whatever it is. It's just part of that, you know, part of your situation.
I know it was a little into your career that you were offered a comedic role. Do you have a preference for drama or comedy?
No, because I don't think of them differently. They're a character, and the choices you have to make to play the character are no different depending on the drama and the comedy. What's different is what the audience is going to get from. But I've never, I take everything, you know, one story at a time, one project at a time. And especially now, I think there's a blur in between, you know, a lot of dramatic things have a lot of humor and vice versa. And that's not, that's just me. People may look at something very, and make that distinction and work it differently and do it, go at it a whole different way from between comedy and drama. I do not. I don't look at them as anything other than this is the job I got to do.
You mentioned that the world is very different today for these students than when you left it. The business is also very different today, and you have YouTube and people with their own YouTube channels and being discovered that way. Do these actors still need an agent, and is there a path to take?
That's like minutia. That's details that would be right for one person, or that's the path they're going to take, and some other person will have a totally different experience. There are no rules. You don't need to do anything other than go forward and try to get to a destination that you're happy with. The world and the way people consume entertainment, theater, whatever, is a whole different world than it used to be. And that's, there is no set answer for that. It's just an individual's, you know, path, you know, and how they're going to choose to get there. And if they, whatever they feel is necessary, they'll try to go for that. And if they get it, great. If they don't, they'll go to the next thing, or they'll veer off the track and they'll do something else.
Well, as they say in theater, Gary, they're giving us the hook.
Yes.
So I want to thank you very much, and congratulations on being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Gary Cole is a star of such movies as Office Space, One Hour Photo, Talladega Nights, and TV shows like The West Wing, The Good Wife, and Veep. He spoke with Colleen Reynolds.
Get your summer started with a dose of the blues. CEFQ presents the GLT Summer Concert featuring Thornetta Davis, Detroit's Queen of the Blues. Get up! Also on stage, it's Los Tex-Maniacs and Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. It's the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, in Museum Square in downtown Bloomington. The music starts at 5, and it's free. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, losing a beloved pet, cloning to get your animal back. We'll explore the idea. Mothers are complicated figures in children's literature, and the role they play in books has inspired a collection of essays that examines their impact, and not just on readers. As we approach Mother's Day this weekend, GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Children's literature is strewn with the corpses of dead mothers. It's a field of the dead through which scholars of children's literature should reassess their thinking. That's according to Illinois State University English professor Karen Coates, co-editor of Mothers in Children's and Young Adult Literature from the 18th Century to Post-Feminism. Coates and her co-editor Lisa Rowe Faustino decided that a thorough examination of the role of the mother in children's literature needed a book of essays from a variety of scholars.
I was a keynote speaker at a conference at Hollins University, which has a summer program for children's and young adult literature, and Lisa Rowe Frustino teaches there. And for years, she has taught a class on mothers in children's and young adult literature, and she asked me to sit in on that and talk about my theories about mothering. And after the class was over, I was like, you need to do a book about this. And she says, oh, I just don't have time. And I said, well, would a co-editor help? And her eyes got big and said, yes. And so that was how this book got started, this project got started. She had a strong background and cohort of students who'd written excellent essays, but also then we opened it up to everyone.
But she is also a young adult author herself.
She is.
What does that bring to the table?
Her perspectives are quite varied in terms of looking at the literature as both a creator and a critic. She's able to, I mean, there's usually two different perspectives on that, and they don't mesh. The things we do as critics, the authors sometimes throw back their heads and howl that this is not what they intended. This is not, this is reading the text differently. And so she, by being on both sides of that, has formed some very strong opinions over time that I think make for a more well-rounded perspective.
So what were you trying to achieve with this collection of essays?
Well, what we were trying to do is get people to think more complexly about mothering. Mothers are often, well, actually always, the most important person in a child's life. And that makes scholarship on mothering difficult because there's a lot of sentimentality involved, but there's also sometimes a lot of anger and unresolved tension and feelings that people bring even into their scholarship. Of course, they would never admit that because scholarship is obviously objective.
Yes.
But we're all working out our own things. So one of the things that happens is that students, as well as literary scholars, on the one hand, they tend to vilify mothers in some way or champion them, whichever. But on the other hand, they just tend to overlook them because it's so naturalized to think about our own childhoods and to think about our own memories and to project those memories onto our readings. However, there's a scholar named Michael Burke who writes about emotional cognition. He says that mothers are one of the five big themes of literature that evoke emotions for people. And so, again, it's one of those things that makes it tricky to theorize because no one wants to theorize too deeply about their own emotions.
And it's interesting because in so many books for young people or children, the mother isn't even there. The mother's absent.
Exactly. And she tends to get, because of her absence, that tends to be sort of the central piece of the character's emotional arc. How do I deal with the loss of my mother? And that's one of the things that Lisa takes up in her essay, primarily because fathers don't get the same kind of attention. I suggested to her that, you know, maybe it's because this scholarly interest in mothers emerged in tandem, but also in tension with second wave feminism. The idea that we need to be recovering an ethics of care, and which is what my colleague here at ISU, Mary Moran's essay is on. But also, feminism wants us to think about women as whole people and not just functionaries in other people's lives.
So being a mother would be a part of a character's life,
exactly.
Not the whole raison d'etre. Mm-hmm.
But then, if you recall, some of the discourse that surrounded that movement, especially second wave feminism, was, you know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. That kind of unconsciously translated to children. Children need their mothers. They don't need their fathers. And so a child needs a father like a fish needs a bicycle. So the next project has to be about fathers because that's demonstrably false. But the point is that mothers bear the burden of guilt. Mothers bear the burden of blame. If you have a dysfunctional mother, then the child's project in a book that focuses on a mother-child relationship is about how the child can do it better, how the child can survive without the mother, how the child needs to get over the death of the mother or the disappearance or her mental illness or whatever. We've got to get rid of her. And I challenge that with my classes to say, why? What is that? But then my daughter wrote a story when she wrote her first fanfic when she was like five.
Wow, precocious.
Yes. And
Was it for Barney?
No, it was for Harry Potter. And
oh,
it was
good.
About Harry and Hermione had gotten married in her story, and they had a daughter named Rosa. And the first thing that happened in her story was that Hermione was killed. And I said, oh, why did you get rid of the mother? And she said, well, Mom, she said, if the mom is in the story, then she's the most important one. Now, I don't know whether that's because of the way she felt about me or whether it's just a recognition of the central position of power that mothers play in children's lives. But it needs to be unpacked. We need to be thinking about that. What does that mean? And what does it mean for little girls and little boys to individuate, to separate themselves from their mother, to turn around and look back at her as a person in their life, maybe still the person in their life, but also they need to become the person in their lives. So it's a separation, it hurts both sides, it's necessary, it doesn't have to be fatal. I guess is what we would say, although in books it often is.
You know, when I think back to one of my favorite characters reading books when I was a kid, and don't wince, but it was Nancy Drew.
Oh, okay.
And Nancy didn't have a mother. She had a father, and she had a mother figure in the housekeeper, Hannah. I love the fact that Nancy didn't have a mother because mm-hmm. Nancy could be more independent and go and do whatever it was basically that she wanted. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the no mother being there allowed her to do that. And it makes me wonder, had Nancy Drew had a mother, I don't think she would have been near the heroine she was.
I've written an essay about Nancy Drew, and I focused on the fact that Freud has a concept where he says that one of our basic drives is what he calls the epistemophilic impulse, the drive to know. And one of the things that is dangerous for a child is knowing too much about their origin, where they came from, whatnot. There, some kids' drive to know is repressed because it's dangerous to know. It's scary to think about, oh, I came from inside someone else. I might go back. At some point, I might have to go back. So one of the things that I talked about in that essay was the fact that Nancy Drew, one of the reasons she doesn't have a mother is because that activates her drive to know. Her drive to know existential questions. What does life mean? What does death mean? She's just driven by this desire to solve mysteries.
Yeah, no wonder she became a detective.
Exactly, exactly. And so, yes, narratively speaking, rhetorically speaking, she needs that freedom. Because if she had a mother there, her mother would say, oh, no, are you going to go out looking like that?
Or, are you crazy? You're out in the middle of the night with Bess and George? No.
Exactly.
Where's Ned Nickerson?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's dangerous. You need protection. So
exactly.
There's that kind of what Sarah Ruddick, who's a scholar, calls maternal thinking, that the mother has basically three jobs. She has to ensure that her child's safety. She has to ensure that the conditions for her child's growth. And she has to make that child acceptable to the wider world. Now, Ruddick, as a good feminist, says, let's throw out that third one, because that's if the wider world is sexist and racist and horrible, why in the world would we want our child to be acceptable to that world? We want the child to change that world. But the other two often are contradictory. So if the conditions for safety say, my child cannot do this thing, and the conditions for growth say, my child must do this thing, the mother has a conundrum. Take climbing a tree. Conditions for safety, shouldn't climb that tree. Conditions for growth, has to climb that tree. And it becomes a place, what Ruddick says, the only answer is humility.
Karen, do you see a fundamental difference between Eastern literature and Western literature in the treatment of mothers?
Actually, yes. Absolutely. In fact, I recently saw a lecture given by Gene Yang, who is mother. He wrote American Born Chinese. And he showed us a picture of a book he read when he was a child. And it was a picture of an adult woman putting her child aside so that her elderly mother could breastfeed. And this is a children's book. And this is the picture on the cover, that her elderly mother is breastfeeding her child while her infant lies crying. You honor your elders in ways that in some ways make you responsible for them, in some, not just physically, but also emotionally, that you are connected in ways that in Western literature, we encourage individuation. And that is something that with global flows, we're starting to question. Is that the best way for this to happen? And there are different.
So not just the boxcar children.
No.
We can have more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Karen, what do you hope will be the reception for your books? What's your hope for your book?
What I would like is for people to look more closely and more analytically. We have an essay, for instance, on animal mothers that anthropomorphize mothers in ways that are not true to their biological function. If a mother is threatened in the wild, you know, we have this idea that the mama bear is going to always protect the cub. No, what the mama bear is going to do is protect her ability to reproduce. And if that means sacrificing the cub, then you sacrifice the cub. That's not a very comforting picture for a young child. And so we water down, but we also fundamentally change the narrative in nonfiction picture books. Another thing that we want to think about is this exactly what we were talking about, the mother as individuating, or the mother as sort of a catalyst for individuation versus thinking about the mother as part of a larger community. And so we have two essays in here, one that I co-wrote with a person named Lauren Causey, whose training is in education, and then another one about mothers from non-white cultures. Do we have theories adequate for understanding? Are we imposing the values of white Western feminism on these maternal models, and what is lost in that? It doesn't help us understand why, when one child is killed in Ferguson, Missouri, the entire community rallies. That's not the white Western model. The white Western model is individuals are responsible for their own behavior, and they do not represent everyone in their culture. Well, what's behind that? And so Lauren and my essay addresses that. It looks at a different kind of theoretical model that is more adequate to a collectivist way of thinking about community versus an individualistic way. The other essay in here by Darina Lazo Gilmore, she writes about minority mamas. And, you know, these are mamas who can be sexual, who can be powerful, who aren't dead.
Wow. Concept.
Who are actively involved in their children's lives. And that's a model that we don't as often see in narratives that adopt this mainstream middle class model. But they're very powerful. I think that is important. So one of our goals is to expand the repertoire of theory in looking at mothers to kind of stop taking them for granted, stop taking their absences for granted, and also stop taking their presence for granted in our literature and see really what they mean, and not in any sort of monolithic way, but in a more plural and multitudinous way of thinking about what mothers mean to us.
That's Karen Coates from Illinois State University's English department. Her book, Mothers in Children's and Young Adult Literature, From the 18th Century to Post-Feminism, is now available. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The book is available from the University Press of Mississippi and is part of an imprint for the Children's Literature Association. Mother's Day is Sunday. Have you ordered your flowers yet? This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a music feature with John Norton. After losing a beloved pet, it's natural to want to have your animal back again. And with cloning technology available, it's very tempting to try and do just that. But is it a good idea? Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of Animal House.
Remember Dolly, the fluffy, winsome sheep from Scotland? She was the first mammal to be cloned from an adult cell. Or was she? If you're thinking of looking into cloning to create a copy of a pet who passed on, Dr. Matt Fraker says you should consider what happened to the first widely known animal clone.
I like to remind people that Church from Stephen King's Pet Sematary, the gray cat, was that when you think about cloning your pet, you're sort of going into the Pet Sematary.
So we're not getting an exact copy when we're cloning.
It's so important to remember that. Correct.
You're not transplanting the animal's personality into a new body.
Exactly. Now there have been people who have been very happy with the results, and these pets were similar enough to the original animal that they were choosing to clone. But also keep in mind the risk factors of spending $100,000 to have an animal cloned and then having it do something unrelated to cloning, like slip a leash and run out in the street and get hit by a car when it's 2 years old.
Yeah.
It's a convoluted conversation in terms of the pros and cons of cloning. In terms of the ethical considerations, there's some concern that some of these animals starts to, you may have to take a couple rounds at it, and in the process you may be creating some creatures that have significant birth defects or what have you. Should we be doing that to try to get back to our original pet? Remembering critically that you're not going to get back to your original pet.
Ever.
In the first place.
Ever.
Right, right. I think another fairly legitimate ethical concern is and this is tough. You know, you're basically telling somebody, you can't tell somebody that their emotions are wrong, and I don't want to say that your emotions are wrong. I'm just saying that if you can step back for a minute and let emotion take a breather, you know, with the money that you're spending to get your pet cloned, the amount of good that you could do for a gazillion pets out there. Plus, in my experience as a dog owner, and I always have three, and when one passes away, I lost one this summer, I go, that means at some point there's going to be a third dog in the Fraker household, and he came along in October. I can't imagine wanting to give up the joy of that discovery process.
Of having a new friend with a new personality,
exactly,
with new memories.
And bringing a whole new, now, I had the dog I'll never have again, and I actually have that church moment every once in a while.
Yes.
If I had a little chunk of him to bury in the pet cemetery, would I do it?
I had a cat like that.
Yeah, right? You know, and you don't ever let those pets go. And it's easy, of course, to translate that emotion, you know, when you think about what humans go through with human loss. There really is a celebratory joy of the new animal. And what is that animal going to bring to your life? Now, it can be disappointment, especially when you come off the high of the greatest dog or cat you've ever had. You know, there's a pretty good chance you may not have that on the next animal. But on the other hand, these cats and dogs, and I'm focusing on you know, sort of the meat and potatoes companion animals, cats and dogs, they're so complicated, and they are all going to bring something new and different. To me personally, it seems like an excessive waste for kind of high risk to take tens of thousands of dollars, $100,000, investing it in an animal that may or may not, may be just as likely to disappoint you as the animal that desperately needs a home. And, you know, we have all these dogs and cats getting nuked every day because there's not enough homes for them. You know, why not take that money, put it into an estate that helps homeless animals, and then somewhere in the process, go find your next new pet?
There was a company in California called BioArts, and they actually cloned a 9/11 search and rescue dog called Tracker. Yes.
I didn't know about this.
Yes, but this company has since gone out of business, and I think they just sort of faced up to the fact that this is not a sustainable business, because how many people can shell out $100,000 to replace a pet? How can you there aren't that many people out there to sustain it. And it's a roll of the dice.
It is. And that's why the analogy to the pet cemetery is probably a little bit darker and a little more dramatic than what's really taking
but
place.
But we all love Stephen King.
Yeah, right. But emotionally, not really. I mean, if you put that much of your investment and emotion into hoping that you get that dog or cat back and things happen, you know, the genetics play out differently and you end up, your dog that lasted 16 years in its first life cloned back, it's juvenile onset kidney failure at 3 years of age, or again, just the regular traumas that can happen. And I'm not saying you just wasted $100,000 for that. Your money is yours to spend. But, I mean, there are some shadowy ethical concerns about the process and how it affects pet ownership in general. The critical notion being this is not an identical twin. And people think that cloning equals identical twin. And this process doesn't give you the identical twin. It gives you something that's going to have different environmental development and perhaps different behavioral, different genetic development.
Perhaps a compromise, I mean, an alternative to cloning, is if you like a particular breed of dog or cat, to go get another of that particular breed. I mean, look at the queen. How many corgis has the queen owned in her lifetime?
30 or something, right?
Exactly. And if you had a great dog who was a corgi and that dog died, instead of cloning, go find yourself another corgi, because that animal likely will have a sort of a similar type of personality and looks and all that kind of stuff that goes with it.
And we see that. I can think of the great owner that we have that sticks to mastiffs. Now, here's a breed. These tan roan mastiffs are their favorites. And I think really probably the most dependable version of that breed, that they know they're in for expensive health issues when they break, probably a shortened lifespan.
Maybe 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years, but sometimes 7, sometimes 8.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care. They're always running around with 2 or 3 mastiffs. And we have the golden retriever owners that are like that. Now, we do also have people who are really scared when they get a great, like, they get the best corgi that we'll ever see. And when that dog passes away, corgis can be, as an example, you know, talking about the queen, corgis sometimes have some behavioral quirks that can make them a little bit more difficult in family situations or whatnot. And so there's that same cloning disappointment possibility. If you have a great, great member of a golden retriever breed, golden retriever is not a good example because they're almost all great dogs. But some of these other breeds where you get
maybe we won't name those other breeds that aren't so great.
Yes, I'll go nameless from here on. But some of the the breeds that are a little bit more variable in behavioral dependency or consistency, excuse me, or medical consistency, where you might have the dog of a lifetime representing that breed, and you run out and try to fill those shoes, and there can be disappointment there. But without question, we do have folks who stick to the breed, to the breed, to the breed. It is sort of like quote unquote cheat cloning, because what we've done with purebreds is pretty hardcore, significant, you know, breeding way down these lines that
they can get very, very specific.
Yes. I mean, when you look at any time you breed a purebred with your purebred, its definition, it's more or less inbreeding. And I'm not condemning it. I'm just saying that, you know, that's why we see the health issues that we see in purebreds. Certain purebreds definitely have higher instances of certain diseases, and that's because of the breeding. But on the other hand, what's the trade-off? Well, you know, we talked about English Bulldogs during our genetic discussion recently. And are English Bulldogs as fun family pets worth the trade-off of ears and skin and allergies? We have a lot of people who certainly think so. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant thought process on how you approach that. But I would 100% agree that it's a lot cheaper to clone by just sticking with the breed that you like than to, you know, pull one out of the ground again.
Come on, we're going to the pet cemetery.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. So, cloning, just don't do it. Instead, give an animal in need a good home. Like the Animal House Pet of the Week. It's Pugsley. This 3-year-old pug pit bull terrier mix is a happy-go-lucky fellow with a friendly attitude and a can-do spirit. Want to go for a romp in the park? Pugsley can do. Want some company to pick up some cheeseburgers at the drive-thru? Pugsley can do. Want to save a soft spot on the sofa for a canine that's ready to claim a soft spot in your heart? Pugsley can do. And you can find Pugsley at Wishbone Canine Rescue in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for one of the Animal House team of experts, let us know at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nashville-based country rockers Adair's Run returns to Six Strings in downtown Bloomington tonight. The four-piece band is touring on their 2016 release Turn Back the Miles and has just released a new single. GLT's John Norton caught up with frontman Todd Hanchock to talk about the album and about growing up in rural West Virginia.
Wheels turning and our hearts burning. We were both free and wild. Yeah, that's what I see when I close my eyes. The
song you're hearing is Turn Back the Miles. It's the title track for the new album by Adair's Run. The band's frontman, Todd Hanchock, joins me. Hi, Todd. How you doing?
Hey, John. How are you, buddy?
Nice to talk with you. Turn Back the Miles. What does it mean?
You know, that was, I will say that was really my pick. I kind of pushed Pat a little bit more on that one. I was like, hey, I think this is kind of the direction of, you know, for us. It's like all these songs that we're writing are based on some serious experiences that we've had over the last couple of years or growing up. For me, Turn Back the Miles is just a cool way to put a spin on, hey, man, I just wish I could turn back time. And especially in that song, you know, that was a relationship that put a huge, you know, mark on me. You know, I learned a lot about myself and other people, obviously, during that. For me, it was kind of like, man, in the relationship that I was in at that time, it was like 0 to 40,000 miles. You know, she was my shotgun rider right there with me. And then we went our separate ways for a while, like 40 to 100,000 miles on that truck. It was a time period. You know, a lot of listeners out there, you know, would like to go. Everybody has, you know, something they'd like to go back and change or relive. And that's what Turn Back the Miles is, just a different way of saying, hey, can I go back in time? You know, roll back the miles on this car that I had to that time period.
Yeah, I remember taking that turn just a little too fast off of Pine Grove. And when we threw out the four-wheel drive, and getting stuck down a sycamore cove. We spent the night in the front seat while you held on to me. And I go back in time just to see that smile. Yeah, so sweet.
Well, let's go way back to the beginning. You come from Princeton, West Virginia.
Yes.
It's called the Jewel of the South. Can you describe Princeton and what it's like there?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of the typical country town. I mean, you know, you got a couple stoplights, you got the get the same hangout spots in the parking lot every Friday night. People cruise a little strip there. It's kind of slowed down, I'd say. I mean, it's kind of the laid back style. Nobody really gets in a hurry. But you know, I grew up, you know, the folks around there are just awesome. It's always like, who can I help? You know, give the shirt off your back. I mean, that's the way I was raised, and everybody is your neighbor down there. Everybody waves at everybody. It's just kind of a friendly feeling, you know.
Well, it's the area where you grew up. It's probably kind of country music heaven, isn't it?
You know, it's kind of varied over the years, as funny as it is. I mean, obviously, there's the way the radio works around there. I mean, it's more geared towards country. But, I mean, obviously, they have all flavors, you know, musical genres there. I would just say, you know, growing up, I kind of saw a mix. I mean, you know, it went from the bounced back and forth from the country to the classic rock to the modern pop and rock. You know, it kind of went all over. But I would say the root of most of the folks there would be in the country.
Well, let's talk about the EP, Turn Back the Miles. First of all, let me play a bit of the opening track called Breakdown on the Interstate.
Started naming them all one by one. All the wrong things I said and done. She pushed me back and said, I don't know why you're here.
Todd, are you the principal songwriter for the band? Do you guys collaborate on this?
Yeah. You know, Pat Polifrone is the guitar player. He is, he and I collaborate a lot. We venture off and write with other folks, obviously, so we don't fall into whole group think. We're always looking for something fresh. So, you know, I'd say Pat and I are the primary songwriters on this particular EP.
So who gets credit for Broke Down on the Interstate?
That would be me. So I'm actually the primary writer on that one. And actually co-wrote that with Brett Traylor. And Brett was one of the original members that started playing with us, and he decided to pursue other interests. And but he still lived in the Nashville area for a while, and we actually co-wrote that song off of a personal experience.
So that comes from you or someone that you knew?
That was definitely something that I lived. I'm always big on putting a twist into a song, and I think that's why I like country music so much, is because there's always that aha moment going into every kind of hook. That you're like, oh, that's a cool little play on words or twist. So, you know, Broke Down the Interstate, it came from a collaboration of a couple experiences I had, one with past relationships, and number two, I actually broke down on the interstate, like my truck did one night at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and the only person that I could finally get a hold of was Brett, the guy that I co-wrote the song with, and as he was picking me up, he says, he broke down the interstate, huh? And I said, yeah, and he goes, yeah, it sounds like a cool song title. He says, does this remind you of so-and-so situation that you had a couple years ago? And I was like, oh man, does this ever take me back? And literally the next night we went and wrote that.
That's when it hit. I was there in 5, fixed her front tire so she could be on her way. And that's when she broke down on the interstate, crying her eyes out, screaming my name.
So the last song on the EP is something you collaborated with Chris Daughtry on.
There was a song that Chris had started like years ago, and we had heard it, you know, really liked it. And this was kind of the time we were just like, man, Pat and I were like, we really just kind of need maybe one or two more songs to add to the EP. We just literally got connected up with Chris and was going to do this song that he basically started. Pat and I got permission. We kind of finished it because we thought it would go a certain way, and Chris just never did, you know, get around to finishing it. But he was like, man, I love it. Like, that's exactly what I wanted to do with it. We ended up finishing, kind of co-writing that song. But it didn't fit the theme of what we were going for once we finished it. So as we got to talking, you know, there was this song called Wild Heart that Chris had actually cut, you know, a side on. And I guess it was going to be a single, and the label, you know, just decided against, you know, releasing it. And I know it was, like, a real important song to Chris. So we got to, you know, as we were kind of talking about the song and listening to it, it's just like, super country the words were, and the country feel, and all the write-ups on the song that we'd read. I mean, obviously, people kind of felt the same way. So I was like, Chris, it'd be really cool to cut a version of that country. He's like, oh man, I would love that. And I was like, but you know what'd be cool? I was like, if you sang on them. I was like, I know this song's real important to you. I was like, let's collaborate and see if we can kind of, you know, help push.
You were burning like a summer, crazy like a fox. You hit harder than a drummer, like a wave on the rocks. You could play me like the lotto, you were playing the part. There ain't nobody could tame you in your wild heart. Yeah. Yeah. Take me back to those barefoot summer nights. Take me back.
This is GLT GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton talking with Todd Hanchock, the front man for the band Adair's Run. Well, you know, that's we're talking about your EP, but you just put out a new single on April 29th, Undefined.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is this something, you know, a taste of what's to come on a new album, or is it just kind of a one-off?
When we put out, you know, the Turn Back the Miles record, for us, it was just kind of, hey, let's just get some of the tunes out there that we're, you know, obviously performing live that are doing a little bit better from live. You know, when we went in with production on that, we kind of had an idea. We wanted to keep it a little bit more raw, you know, guitars, bass, drums. So we really kind of developed into figuring out, hey, what's the live sound? You know, trying to predict where country music's going to go is, you know, like trying to find a needle in a haystack these days. You can't at all. But once we kind of really narrow down, hey, the kind of the sound, and we like to say, like, we're kind of like Matchbox 20 meet Jason Aldean. That's where Undefined came from. It was really cool. We went into a writing session with a guy named Adam Schoenfeld, phenomenal guitar player in his town. In fact, he's done most of the guitar work on famous folks like I just mentioned, you know, Luke Bryan and Jason Aldean, just to name a few. We write the song. I walked in, and I was like, man, I got this idea. It's called Undefined. You know, to me, it really depicts how a lot of relationships are these days, especially with the younger generation. It just almost seems like it's, you know, nobody wants to put a title on anything. Oh, it's really cool, you know. The song, within about an hour and a half, we were done. Put it in the oven, and that's what came out. And it was like, that is a much more clear depiction of our live sound and what we're going for now. It ain't the truth. It
ain't a lie. To tell you the truth. That's Todd Hanchock of Adair's Run speaking with GLT's John Norton. The song you're hearing is the band's just-released single, Undefined. You can see Adair's Run tonight at the Six Strings Club in downtown Bloomington. Doors open at 7 p.m. Music begins at 10. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks to Judy Valente, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton for today's show. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas by tweeting the hashtag Sound Ideas. Find the interviews and full episodes of the show at WGLT.org. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.